Okay, so the third noble truth, the noble truth of cessation of suffering and its origins, specifically refers to what happens in the mind when we generate the direct realization of emptiness. So it's not to reach that point, one needs to have a correct intellectual comprehension of emptiness, which opposes the mistaken conceptions and mistaken ideas of ultimate reality of emptiness. And then still that correct intellectual understanding of emptiness, even when the mind is single-pointed, perfectly concentrated, still there's an element of mistake. Because when we have an intellectual understanding of something, we call that a conceptual mind, a concept which means that we have an idea of the object of that consciousness. So if we study emptiness and we get a correct intellectual understanding of emptiness, there appears in our mind a mental image, this personal picture of emptiness. Now that is not emptiness. That is our idea of emptiness. Emptiness exists. Emptiness is an existing phenomenon. It is the ultimate nature of all things, not just the self, but whatever exists has the quality of being empty, existing inherently or truly or in its own right. So when we gain that intellectual understanding, even though it's correct, the element of confusion is that we confuse our idea of emptiness, our conception of emptiness, with emptiness itself, with the actual phenomenon of emptiness. So we need to go even further in our meditation and break through our idea of emptiness and have what we say the direct awareness of emptiness itself, to directly perceive emptiness. Then there is no idea, there's no mental image of emptiness appearing. Emptiness is appearing to that wisdom consciousness. The intellectual understanding, even though correct, did not have the power to eradicate the levels of ignorance, the self-grasping ignorance. It's only the direct experience which has the power to bring to an end the obscurations or the levels of ignorance. And the many levels of ignorance, first there's intellectual obscurations. We've talked before about belief in a permanent, partless and independent self. So that belief is a mistaken idea of emptiness. It is an intellectually acquired idea. It is something which we've learned. Some teacher has taught us that there is a soul. Each person has a soul which is independent. It doesn't have parts, it's just a single entity. And it's permanent, it doesn't change moment by moment, it remains the same. So that is a belief, a mistaken belief. And that exists in the mind of those who have acquired that mistaken belief. Then there are innate mistaken conceptions. So we're born with the mistaken self-grasping conception, you know, the idea, because we died with it in our past life. And we had it existed at that mistaken conception, obscured our mind, not just in the past life, but in every life, going back without beginning. Our mind has always been obscured by the innate misconceptions of the self to exist inherently in its own right, independent of anything else. And of course there's an appearance. Because it's a conception, there is a mental image of an I who exists in our own right. And ordinarily, because we have this mistaken conception, the seeds of the mistaken self-grasping conception, when we experience things in this life as a habit from past lives, there's a fault, an acquired fault in our mind or an inherited fault in our mind, is that our own self, when we think I, there appears, there's a wrong appearance of a truly existing I to that thought. Not only is there the image, this mental image of of the I, but that I appears as an inherently existing, and we take that appearance to be true. And so that's the self-grasping ignorance. In more detail, whenever we think I, like say somebody says, rings us up and says, can we meet at such and such a shop and have a coffee together? We say, yep, I will meet you there at 10 o'clock and we'll have a good talk. So when we're thinking I will meet you, we are referring to the existing I and the existing friend, the person of the existing friend. They're the ones we are referring to. But to our thought, I and you, there's the appearance of an inherently existing I, which is wrong. So in our everyday self-awareness, there's a mixture of the correct appearance of an I who is not, who doesn't exist in the way ignorance sees it, and the incorrect appearance. So I is empty of inherent existence, and inherently existing I. It's mixed. We can't distinguish between one or the other. So when we're meditating on emptiness, when we gain the intellectual understanding of emptiness, we clearly see the fault in the appearance of an inherently existing I. And so that wisdom, seeing that we're empty of existing in the way we're inherently, at that time, although the appearance does not obscure the mind, there is still the appearance, the idea, the mental image of a conventionally existing I, the I that does exist, which we confuse to be the real I. So that intellectual understanding, that wisdom, doesn't have the power to remove the underlying seeds of self-grasping ignorance. It's only when we eliminate all appearance of the I, inherently existing, even conventionally existing, and our mind is focused on emptiness itself, there is no appearance of the conventional I, no appearance of inherently existing I. The mind, the wisdom mind, is directly perceiving reality of emptiness of inherent existence, our ultimate nature. That is the cure. That is the antidote. That wisdom has the power to destroy the ignorance. So the ignorance has many levels. I've already said there's the intellectually acquired ignorance, and then there's the innate ignorance. And innate has gross, subtle, gross, medium, and subtle levels. And then, if we want to go even further, there's gross, gross, medium, gross, and subtle, gross, medium, 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 and subtle, medium, and gross, small, medium, small, and small, small levels of ignorance. So there are many. And they are progressive. Through meditation and emptiness, we progressively abandon the gross down to the most subtle or the small obscurations. Each time our wisdom reaches a level on the path that extinguishes, say, the gross ignorance, we achieve true cessation. There is an emptiness in the mind. Like initially, the very first third truth, very first true cessation, is an emptiness in the mind of all intellectually acquired ignorance. And so that emptiness is a permanent state, like an unchanging state of vacuity or absence of that level of ignorance. Then, with the further development, accumulation of merit, and the greater power of concentration, focusing on the same object, emptiness of inherent existence, on the path we progressively abandon and achieve true cessation of the gross, the medium gross, and so on, those levels of ignorance. So the third noble truth, cessation, refers to the cessation of the root cause of karma and the other afflictions. And obviously, cessation of suffering, which is results from them. So it progresses, the third truth progresses in volume, in depth, as the bodhisattva approaches Buddhahood. And so, as the wisdom, the power of concentration to wisdom gets stronger, stronger and stronger, then the levels of ignorance get weaker and weaker and weaker. There's true cessation. So that's what this diagram talks about. Now, I'm sure you've all heard, you're aware of the presentation of Buddhism of the Eightfold Noble Path. It's particularly emphasized in the Theravada tenets, in the texts, and as also is mentioned, of course, in the Mahayana texts. The Mahayana presentation of the Eightfold Noble Path specifically refers to achievements attained on the path of meditation, whereas it's more general, presented in the Theravada path. But at the bottom of the sixth page, these eight are mentioned. Correct view. So this is the knowledge or the wisdom which opposes the five wrong views. We didn't talk about them, but the five wrong views are, or afflicted views, are on page five. They belong to the sixth group of six root afflictions. And they are the view of the perishable group as a real eye and mind. The perishable group refers to the body and mind. the group of five aggregates. They're perishable because they're changing moment by moment. So this is the afflicted view, or the mistaken view, that observes the I and mine of one's own continuum of body and mind, and holds the I to be intrinsically existent. When we say I and mine, this wrong view refers to self-grasping of person, of one's own person, to exist truly. Now, clearly, when we think I, we're referring directly to the person, to one's own person. And so there is the conception that I exist inherently. Mine refers to one's the aggregates, the body and mind. So when we think my body, my mind, then although the body and mind are not the I, they're regarded as possessions of the I. And the dominant aspect of the thought mine, you know, this is my cup. The dominant aspect is me. Is the position of me, or my face, my body, my mind. The dominant appearance to that thought is the person, is I. So, but it's the referent is, or the body and mind. So that is also self-grasping of person. This is the point. Self-grasping of phenomenon is when we regard the cup or the clock or whatever as inherently existing from its side. You know, it's not just a cup, it's an inherently existing cup, to, you know, and so on, inherently existing clock. That's the object is not a person. The object is a something other than a person. Is that okay? A little bit convoluted, but this first of the five wrong views, the view of the perishable group, body and mind, as real I and mine, is self-grasping of person. All right. Extreme view then regards the person or the I or mine of one's own continuum and conceives, has the conception that the I is annihilated at death. It's totally end of the line. There is no continuum whatsoever. Or, that's one extreme. The other extreme is that the inherently existing I that we conceive exists forever into the future. It is the same me, unchanging, inherently existing me, who's going on to the next life, or go to heaven, or go to hell. Same continuum. That is also extreme. You know, Buddha taught that the person who exists is merely exists by name, merely exists as imputed upon the body and mind, that you have this basis, a functioning body and mind which functions as a human being. So there's a functioning entity, a combination of body and mind, which when we think of mind, there's automatically the thought, I. So I is merely labelled upon the body and mind. There is a person of this life who functions, who is born, who eats, drinks, sleeps, grows up, is educated, gets sick, and so on. That is the person identified by the name given to us by our parents. And so we validly exist at the conventional level. We sign our signature. That's good enough for checks and various legal, how do we say, identifications of the persons, our signature, and then our signature plus a photograph. And now they're going more, aren't they? Fingerprints, eyes, even our chromosomes identify the person. But the signature is not the person. Photograph's not the person. The face, which is photographed, is not the person. The chromosomes are not the person. If we look for the conventionally existing person who has a passport which identifies them through the name and allows us to enter a country, but the person that has been allowed to get into the country, if we really check, well, where is he or she? Can't be found. There is a body and a mind. So we only conventionally exist in dependence upon our name and that which bears our name in this life. Ultimately, if we try to, if this, the I did exist as we believe, inherently in its own right, then the more we remove what is not I, the closer and closer we'll become to discovering the real I. If we were existed truly as we think we do. But under analysis, nothing can be found to be the I. Under ultimate analysis. But when we're not analysing, and our friend rings up and says, "Will you meet me at the coffee shop at 10 in the morning?" We say, "Yes, I will be there." And we will be there. And the person will say, "Hello," and they'll mention our name. So the meeting of two conventional persons existing, but at that table, if we really analyse, the conventional person's not there. Okay. So, what about this extreme view? The person totally ceases at death. Oh, that's not an afflicted view, that's true. It's true in terms of the gross basis of labelling of the I, this body and this mind. Only this body and this mind, the combination, can be correctly identified as me, the person, of this life. And when we die, the body, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, completely disintegrates. The mind becomes completely subtle and separates. There's no longer a suitable combination, a combination of body and mind suitable to bear my name. So the person of this life ceases. However, within the body and mind, there is the most subtle mind and the most subtle form or body or wind energy at the center of the heart, which at death is all that remains alive. There is subtle consciousness, or clear light consciousness, and that mind bears all of the seeds of both our disturbing emotions and our constructive emotions. It bears the seeds of our memories of past lives. It bears the karmic propensities that haven't yet ripened. And that separates, and that becomes the cause of the intermediate state existence, and then there's a death at the end of the intermediate state, and that most subtle wind of mind carries into the womb of the future mother. So there is a continuity which exists now, survives death, bears all of the unique characteristics, mental characteristics of the person, and those influence future lives. So, in other words, this combination of both subtle body and mind is the final basis of imputation of the person. And that is the person who goes from life to life. So, although the person of this life totally ceases at death, that's only the gross basis of imputation of person, the gross body, the gross mind of this life. The subtle one, the final basis of imputation, is not destroyed at death. And it came, that too, came from beginningless past and will go on endlessly into the future. But you see, during life, what we can do, if we practice the path, we can progressively extinguish the seeds of the afflictions born upon the most subtle mind and wind, the mere I. And so it's changing moment by moment because it's physical, the wind, and it's mental, the awareness, the clear light awareness. So it's changing moment by moment. It's not permanent in terms, it doesn't change. It does change. And the whole point of practicing Dharma with our gross bodies and minds is that during it, in meditation on emptiness, we can progressively eliminate the seeds of the afflictions from the continuity of clear light, wind and mind, so that mere I approaches the point where it's suitable to be called a Buddha. And there's true cessation. The third noble truth, there is cessation of those seeds of the afflictions occurs. And the karma naturally stops. It cannot ripen after the very first realization of emptiness. Alright, so anyway, that's what this is about. I'm just preparing the ground. Extreme views. The third afflicted view is holding one's false view as supreme. This regards one's perishable, extreme or wrong views to be correct and the best view for gaining realizations. The fourth is holding wrong morality and asceticism as supreme. So this is the idea, the belief, that sees physical or verbal or mental wrong actions to be correct and superior methods for attaining liberation. You know, putting steel rods through your skin and dragging heavy carts and that sort of stuff. There are lots of examples of in India of the extreme practices which are just they believe to be true, but unfortunately it's not the way to purify karma. To purify karma, you've got to cut the root. And wrong view is not just not knowing, but it's a strongly held, intellectually acquired, mistaken idea that denies karmic cause and effect, denies rebirth, denies the three jewels, and so on. So, when we talked about karma, we mentioned the depth of wrong views. It's very powerful. Okay, so we're going back now to the Eightfold Noble Path at the bottom of page 6. So correct view refers to view is knowledge, wisdom, which opposes those five wrong views. Correct realization refers especially to the wisdom that analyzes and realizes subtle emptiness. in that small bit above that, you can see that the emptiness of a permanent, partless and independent self and the emptiness of self-sufficient and substantial self
are gross
levels of emptiness. They're correct, but they're more gross compared to the subtle emptiness, the emptiness of inherent or true existence. So correct realization realizes all three levels of emptiness and teaches them without mistake. Correct speech, first of all,
refers to
verbal vows of restraint against wrong actions, vows taken by laity or by monks and nuns.
So, verbal vow. When we take a vow, if we take refuge, we take the refuge vows, or if we take the levels of ordination of monks and nuns, it is essential to verbally recite those vows,
following upon the master, the initiating master who's bestowing the vows.
That verbal action is the creation, from the present giga point of view, that creates a subtle change in our body. There is a physical change resultant upon the verbal recitation of vows. That change is not visible to the eyes. It is visible to mental consciousness, clairvoyant mental consciousness. So, a realized person who has clairvoyance, they will know whether we have vows or not. If we've broken our vows, then that subtle change is gone. And so, high lamas with that clairvoyant awareness can look around the group. They'll know who has the vows and who doesn't have them. This subtle physical change appearance of the mind. So, correct speech, it involves taking vows of restraint, restraining from harmful actions, from immoral actions, of killing, stealing, lying, sexual misconduct and so on. Those actions which harm others. This is so important because this is the foundation of the spiritual path, to have restraint from harming others. It is the fundamental meaning of taking refuge in Dharma. The essential meaning of taking refuge in Dharma is to avoid harmful actions towards others. Whether you take the vow or not, like in simple refuge where you don't take the vows, you still have this conscious commitment to not harm sentient, but not deliberately harm sentient beings in any way. That is your refuge in Dharma. In dependence upon that, we can then, our mind is then made capable of advancing on the path through meditation, through cultivating the power of concentration and cultivating wisdom, bodhicitta, etc. is dependent upon pure morality. It is the foundation of the path and it has to be established verbally. It's not good enough to just not kill, to just not lie, to just not steal. I mean, in our society, the ethics of our society are clearly based upon Judeo-Christian morality of not killing, stealing, lying. And that's actually natural morality too. You don't need a teacher to inform you that harming others by killing them, stealing, lying, is a harmful experience for them and even for oneself. It's naturally negative. But the verbal expression of taking the vows, that subtle form, that subtle change, means that if you take refuge and you vow to not kill, deliberately kill a sentient being for the rest of this life, then due to that subtle change in your physical form, you accumulate the positive karma of not killing 24 hours a day, even when you're asleep. And this is why this is presentation of this subtle form. That is the agent by which you accumulate positive karma. Now, if we're an ordinary member of society, we've never taken any vow not to kill, steal or lie, but we don't. We conform to the laws of the land. We only accumulate the positive karma of not killing when there is a situation where there might be an impulse to kill, usually an insect or a so-called pest, rat, mouse, whatever. And only if we oppose that impulse by thinking of the poor creature suffering, being pain, and instead of killing it, we catch it, put it outside, or whatever, then that action creates the virtue, very powerful, of not killing. But that's the end of the story. If you have a vow, it's not just that one momentary action, it's 24 hours a day, for as long as you keep it. It's a big difference. And this is why living in pure morality is the foundation of the spiritual path. Because it generates strength, self-confidence, and inner power, inner psychological power to overcome the distractions in our mind and external, which prevent us from practicing Dharma. Okay, so correct speech is verbally taking vows, and secondly, it is teaching emptiness without contradiction. So I might have just blown it by giving you some explanation of emptiness, and I probably contradicted myself. Sorry. One day I'll be able to teach without contradiction. Correct aim of actions is following the vows and restraining from non-virtuous actions. So again, the first step is taking the vow, and then correct aim is to put those vows into practice, and not be a hypocrite. The fifth is correct livelihood. So this is to obtain the sources of material sources for living, to do so without causing harm to animals or to people by cheating, stealing, and so on. Correct effort is having strong enthusiasm for engaging in virtuous activities and maintaining those virtue activities, not reaching a point where I think, oh, I've done enough, I can take a break now, I deserve a holiday, but continuing on and also continuing to abandon non-virtue. Correct mindfulness is maintaining mindfulness upon the virtuous objects of meditation throughout the day, not just when you're sitting on your cushion, but to maintain, to consciously keep your mind focused on virtue throughout the day and even when you're dreaming. Correct concentration is generating single-pointed concentration on your virtuous objects of the path of meditation. All right. So that's a general presentation of the Eightfold Noble Path. Now, specifically in this chart, there is a presentation of the fourth noble truth, true paths, in a more detailed fashion. So what I've done, I've drawn two parallel lines encompassing this arrow. So going off this way, the point indicates the continuity of the stream of consciousness. So that big thick arrow represents mind,
the stream of consciousness. And you can see on the left side of the page, it's open, and there's a label,
samsara. So samsara is not out there. Your mind is samsara.
You right?
The mind under the control of karma and afflictions.
That is samsara.
So it's open-ended because it has a beginningless past.
And I've got the arrow, mental continuum. So this represents your mental continuum moving across the page from left to right.
Now,
initially,
you,
through karma, you
meet
a qualified teacher in this life who teaches you about the reality of rebirth, karma, the Four Noble Truths. And so
you gain what they call the fear, or the intelligent
fear of being reborn in the three lower realms. You generate faith in the three jewels as being valid presentations of reality.
And you generate compassion. We're talking about the Bodhisattva's path. So there are three levels of refuge according to the three scopes of Dharma practice. We're talking about the third scope. And the Bodhisattva has fear, not for his or her suffering in samsara, but for the suffering of others, of sentient beings. And so they haven't yet become a Bodhisattva, but the person with the seed of the lineage through prior connection with the lineage of bodhicitta, they have this seed of bodhicitta. So they take refuge through those three qualities: fear, faith, and compassion, universal compassion for others. So at the moment of taking refuge, which generally there's a high lama, and there's a small ceremony where you go and you do that action of reciting the refuge formula under the guidance of the lama. At that point, when the lama snaps his fingers or her fingers, your mind is established in the aspect of refuge in the three jewels. The Tibetan, the literal translation of the term in Tibetan is, you become an inner being, which means inwardly in your mind. I think this is the meaning. Inwardly, your mind is now established in the aspect of refuge in the three jewels. So that colours your entire mental consciousness, is in the aspect of refuge. And a person with clairvoyance will know whether a person has genuine refuge in the three jewels or not. I mean, you could even be wearing robes of a monk and have your rosary around your arm and malas and all the apparent signs of a Buddhist practitioner, but you may not have even refuge, let alone the vows of a monk or nun. And the lamas will know, so you can't trick them. Often people trick themselves. They think they have vows, but actually, I mean, this isn't putting us down. Yeah, I think I can say this. We all say, I've received tantric initiation, tantric empowerment.
Yes.
Well, we have attended a tantric initiation, and we've been given permission to do the meditations by a very compassionate Vajra Master. But to actually have the empowerment is very, very rare. Nevertheless, it's important to attend empowerments as one's understanding grows more and more, to the point where you can do the required visualization and meditation during the empowerment on the basis of at least intellectual clear understanding of emptiness, bodhicitta, and renunciation. Then there certainly is an imprint on our mind, and we are given permission to do the meditation. But whether you see, the point is, to actually receive a highest yoga tantra initiation, you will become a Buddha during that initiation. Right? So that's the actual. So there's a whole spectrum of blessings and initiations established on a mind stream before that. Do you see what I mean? Okay. So, our mind is now in the aspect of refuge. So, we receive more teachings and we meditate on the three basic aspects, renunciation, bodhicitta, and wisdom. And at the same time, we cultivate our powers of, based upon the initial morality established through refuge, we accumulate merit. We accumulate a vast amount of merit, and on the basis of morality and merit, we train our mind in concentration, in meditation. Up to the point of achieving, you go through the 9 stages of mental development, up to the point of single point of concentration. Then, which means we can remain focused upon the object effortlessly as long as we wish. Incredible power of concentration. That's not enough. On top of that, we have to generate jine or karma bhati. So now, I'd mentioned before the desire realm, form realm, and formless realm. So now, as humans, we have to, in our meditation, our mind has to enter the form realm level of meditation. And as there are stages into the first level of the form realm. So we enter the first and the second stages, and we achieve calm abiding or mental quiescence, where there's an incredible experience of mental and physical bliss, which is a little bit distracting, but persevering that bliss, the distracting distractedness stops, and the mind is unbelievably focused upon the object of meditation. At that point, we've achieved calm abiding. Now, there are different things to do from here on, depending upon the particular teachings we've received, but we're focusing upon Dharma topics. So, having achieved calm abiding, we now focus our mind upon the teaching of the Four Noble Truths. True suffering in particular, true suffering and the true causes of suffering. And we generate the realization that it's all useless. The disadvantages, all yesterday we talked about the disadvantages of samsaric existence. So we change our whole mind. Now let's go of grasping at the apparent real pleasure of mundane existence under the control of karma and afflictions, and we turn our mind towards liberation and enlightenment. In the single point of concentration, that is the moment of attaining renunciation. Prior to that, we don't have the actual realization of renunciation. We have contrived renunciation, which is great. Of course, we have a degree, but we don't have the actual realization of renunciation. Then,
Having generated renunciation, we can either focus our attention on emptiness or upon bodhicitta, upon generating great compassion and the universal sense of universal responsibility to achieve Buddhahood for the benefit of all beings, and then bodhicitta. So, in single point of concentration, the realization of emptiness can precede bodhicitta, or bodhicitta can precede emptiness. It depends upon our mental capacity. Either way, with the development of actual bodhicitta, conventional bodhicitta, on the basis of renunciation, on the basis of calm abiding, on the basis of pure morality, of living in vows, at that point of generating bodhicitta, actual bodhicitta, one enters the bodhisattva's path. That is the beginning of the bodhisattva's path. So, on top of the line, where, above, I haven't written it there, but above the mind, ordinary person. Right, so you're an ordinary person when you take refuge. Then, when you generate actual bodhicitta, as it's, you can see, there's a line down there. So now, the entire mental consciousness has bodhicitta. And you become an ordinary bodhisattva. Beginning of the bodhisattva's path. And that's the point of entry into the first of the five paths, the five mental paths to enlightenment. The path of accumulation, which will be followed by the path of preparation, then the path of seeing, the path of meditation, and finally, the path of no more learning, which is at the very end. And just NML means no more learning. Alright? So, you are now an ordinary bodhisattva, and you have entered the path of accumulation. Your mind hasn't entered, your mind has become the bodhisattva's path of accumulation. Right? It has become the path of accumulation. Which we can divide into three levels, small, medium, and great. During this path, the mind accumulates merit, clearly. Accumulation refers to accumulation of merit, accumulation of more knowledge, understanding emptiness, and the accumulation of the more greater and greater power of concentration. So, you know, single point of concentration, even calm abiding, is just not a one-off thing. It always qualifies as calm abiding, but as calm abiding is supported by greater strength of concentration and greater accumulation of merit, then the whole mind is so much stronger. So the mind grows stronger on the path of accumulation. And at the very beginning, just entering the small level of the path of accumulation, under some circumstances, it's possible to briefly, momentarily, lose bodhicitta. In which case you would lose the path of accumulation and you'd go back to being an ordinary being and you wouldn't be a bodhisattva. But that, you know, there are stories in the text, you've heard the stories. That is a temporary thing and you would regenerate bodhicitta. And once you advance to the medium level of path of accumulation, you can never lose bodhicitta. Your mind will always be a bodhicitta up until Buddhahood. And that bodhicitta will grow stronger and stronger too. Just as your refuge is growing stronger and stronger and stronger. So at the end of the great level of the path of accumulation, now you are focusing more and more on emptiness, greater power of concentration, and you have the realization of emptiness at the intellectual level. So you have what I referred before, the conceptual realization of emptiness. Once that is stabilized and strong, your mind then becomes the path of preparation. That's the path of prep. So your whole mind is path of preparation, and this literally means preparation to realize emptiness directly. So similarly, there's accumulation of merit, there's accumulation of greater and greater power of concentration, and greater insight into emptiness. And so it has four levels: heat, peak, patience, and HMD, which means highest mundane Dharma. Dharma with a small d, meaning phenomenon. Supreme mundane quality. It has many ways of calling it, but I highest mundane Dharma or supreme mundane. So heat, because like as you're getting close to a fire, it gets warmer. So the fire is the wisdom directly realizing emptiness. So you're getting warm, you're going to burn up the afflictions. Peak is getting higher and higher. Patience or forbearance is at that level, the third level of the path of preparation. Literally, the texts say at that point the bodhisattva can never ever be born in the three lower realms. But in the personal teachings of Geshe Jabba Techo, once you reach the medium level of the path of accumulation, it is impossible to be born in the three lower realms. So patience or forbearance then leads to that final meditation session where you generate calm abiding, focus upon emptiness and on your intellectual understanding of emptiness. And that meditation is so powerful, supported by so much merit, that you finally dissolve away your idea, your mental image of emptiness, which is correct, but it obscures realizing emptiness as it is, not your idea of emptiness, and you achieve the wisdom directly realizing emptiness. So at that point of generating the wisdom directly realizing emptiness, your mind becomes the path of seeing. And these hatched lines that I've drawn, the first ones with the lines going downwards is called the uninterrupted path. So you have entered the uninterrupted path of the bodhisattva's path of seeing. Uninterrupted, because that concentration is not interrupted by the intellectual obscurations to liberation, or the acquired ignorance, the acquired obscurations to liberation. At the end of that, it's only a short time, of that uninterrupted path, you achieve the first true cessation. The first aspect of the third noble truth, there is true cessation of the intellectually acquired ignorance, those mistaken views which you learnt during this life. They cease. And so immediately your mind becomes the liberated path, of the path of the bodhisattva's path of seeing. Right. And when you rise from that meditation, then the blank spit is still your mind. Your mind becomes the post-meditational wisdom. So the bodhisattva has just entered the path of sin
has, upon arising from that meditation, because the Bodhisattva has only abandoned the intellectually acquired obscurations to liberation, there are still the obscurations to omniscience, as well as the innate obscurations to liberation. So, things, Bodhisattva's eyes are open, looking around, things still appear to exist inherently. But the Bodhisattva knows that is an illusion and does not grasp that appearance to be true.
So several things have happened on graduating our mind. When our mind graduates from path of preparation to path of seeing,
one is no longer an ordinary Bodhisattva. One becomes an Arya Bodhisattva. One attains true cessation, the first level of true cessation. And one enters the first of the 10 Bodhisattva grounds. There are 10 grounds or paths that the Bodhisattva must now progress through to achieve Buddhahood. From the beginning of the path of seeing onwards. So in this ground, the perfection of generosity is perfected. So during that post-meditational state, then the Bodhisattva still must accumulate merit, must accumulate greater power of concentration and greater depth of concentration onto emptiness, and simultaneously perfect the first of the six perfections, the six common perfections, the perfection of generosity. And when that perfection is attained, all that needs to be attained on the path of seeing is achieved. At the end of that path of seeing, the Bodhisattva again goes into meditation and reaches the point where the wisdom directly realizing emptiness is so powerful that it can now abandon the gross, innate obscurations to liberation, the gross afflictions. And so there's another uninterrupted path occurs at the beginning of the next path, the path of meditation. Upon achieving that, there is true cessation of the gross afflictions, and that is immediately followed by what we call a liberated path. The mind is now liberated from those gross afflictions. And as one comes out of meditation, one is on the first level of the path of meditation, and one enters the second Bodhisattva's ground, the perfection of ethical conduct, of morality. So underneath, now you've all heard the teachings that it takes a Bodhisattva a minimum of 3 countless great eons to achieve Buddhahood. So the first countless great eon, the collection of merit, began upon becoming a Bodhisattva, as you see, and it is completed upon entering the path of meditation. So it didn't happen very quickly. A countless great eon is a vast, enormous amount of time, and you're being reborn again and again and again, accumulating merit until you reach the path of meditation. So similar sequence of events for the next 6 levels of the path of meditation. One completes progressively
achieves the perfection of the perfections of patience, enthusiastic perseverance, concentration, wisdom, and method. So we're two-thirds of the way along the path of meditation. We've reached the seven bodhisattva ground, and there have been many uninterrupted paths followed by liberated paths as the bodhisattva graduates from one of those sub-levels to the next. And during that time, all of the innate obscurations to liberation are about the afflictions. So not only is there gross ignorance, medium gross ignorance, subtle gross ignorance, but there's gross attachment, medium gross attachment, subtle gross attachment, and anger, and so on and so on. So these are all progressively abandoned with more and more true cessations established upon the mind stream right up until the end of the seventh bodhisattva ground, or the sixth level of the path of meditation, when the final, most subtle obscuration to liberation is abandoned at the end of that seventh stage, and upon achieving the liberation, the liberated path of the seventh level of the path of meditation, the bodhisattva has now abandoned all obscurations to liberation and has achieved the bodhisattva's nirvana, the bodhisattva's state of arhat. One is still an Arya bodhisattva, but that's not the end of the line. One has completed the second countless great eon during that time. So I've only got one countless great eon to go. And that's the minimum time, don't forget. It could be longer. So towards the end of the path of meditation, there are final three bodhisattva grounds to be progressed upon, and the seventh, eighth, ninth levels are the path of bodhisattva's path of meditation. So the bodhisattva's main purpose has been to abandon the obscurations to omniscience. These are not afflictions. They're not the obscurations to liberation are the afflictions. But these are not afflictions. They're neither mind nor form. They belong to the category of phenomena which are neither mind nor form. They're changing, but they're not mind nor form. And they manifest as the appearance of inherent existence. When you're out of meditation, clearly that appearance isn't there when you're on the uninterrupted, liberated paths, because you're focused directly on emptiness. But when you come out, there's still this subtle appearance of inherent existence. And those are the obscurations to omniscience, the obscurations to becoming a Buddha. So they have to be progressively abandoned on the 8th, 9th and 10th bodhisattva grounds. And there are 10 perfections. Normally we only talk about 6, but there are actually 10. So on those grounds, one achieves perfection, completion of the perfection of prayer, of power, and of wisdom. And so that takes another countless great eon. Even though the bodhisattva is an arhat, has nirvana, has no afflictions, still another countless great eon to accumulate the merit, the power of concentration, to abandon those most subtle obscurations to omniscience. So it's only when, after another countless great eon, the bodhisattva enters the final meditation and generates uninterrupted path, which is the antidote to the most subtle obscuration to omniscience
and that is extinguished, and the path of liberation is now on the path of no more learning. The mind is now omniscient, and the person is no longer an Arya Bodhisattva, the person is now an Arya Buddha. So, liberated from the most subtle obscuration to omniscience. And that's an arrow, because that mind, that's the same mind stream that began with samsara. So this is how we destroy samsara. And that will continue endlessly into the future, working for sentient beings, effortlessly helping sentient beings. So what is the most subtle obscuration to omniscience? Any idea? It's an appearance of inherent existence, right? But of what? All right. Huh? Of what? Yeah, it is a phenomenon, but what phenomenon? Okay. This is where highest yoga tantra comes in. The most subtle, and we've talked about, during my visit here, we've talked about the death experience. Remember? During dying, the winds gather in towards the central channel, and the gross consciousnesses stop. They cease functioning. And the winds start to flow towards the central channel from above, towards the heart chakra, above and below. And as they come down from above, you get the white appearance. Now, that white appearance appears to inherently exist. So, in order to extinguish that appearance of inherent existence with the wisdom realizing emptiness, one has to generate the white appearance in meditation, in single point of meditation. And then, be aware of the appearance of inherent existence, of the white appearance, and extinguish that through the wisdom directly realizing emptiness. Then, there's the red appearance. Appears inherent existing. We have to extinguish that appearance through direct meditation on emptiness. Then they all come together. There's the black, what do they call it? Black appearance of near attainment, you know. Appears inherent existing. That has to be extinguished with wisdom realizing emptiness. Then there is the clear light appearance. The clear light appearance never appears to exist inherently, even in ourselves. Even when we die, and briefly there's the clear light appearance, that does not appear as inherently existing. It is free, primordially free from the false appearance. So, but although the appearance of inherent existence of the white vision, red vision, and black vision have stopped as we died, they didn't stop as a result of meditation on emptiness. They just naturally stopped because the appearance stopped. Like if I smash the cup, the appearance of inherent existence of the cup will stop, but didn't stop through wisdom. In the Lama Chöpa, you know, when we offer the mandala in the middle of the Lama Chöpa, and we recite what Rinpoche said, that prayer, three times in English, may I extinguish the subtle dualistic appearance of the white, red, black visions. So that is the purpose of Tantra. It is only through the practice of Tantra, highest yoga Tantra, that one can enter consciously, actively. One can cause the winds to enter into the central channel and experience those visions whilst meditating on emptiness, the clear light. So there is no other way to remove those final obscurations to omniscience other than through the power of meditating on the central channel through Hatha Yoga Tantra. So the Bodhisattva even has followed the Paramitayana path, you know, the sutra path, for three countless great eons. Still, upon achieving the 10th Bodhisattva's ground and going into that final concentration, the Bodhisattva must invoke the methods of highest yoga tantra to, in that last uninterrupted path, to extinguish the final obscurations to omniscience. And it is said that if the Bodhisattva has not entered the tantric path until that point, then Manjushri will appear within that, during that meditation, and will guide the Bodhisattva into the meditational method to eliminate those final obscurations to omniscience. From then on, the Arya Buddha, omniscient mind, remains in the clear light. It never becomes gross again. The omniscient mind never has conceptual activity. There is never experience of things through a mental image. The power, why, like in samsara, what is the power which causes us to continually take rebirth after we die? It's grasping at existence, grasping at life, grasping at me. But that self-grasping ignorance initiates karmic activity through which we create causes for rebirth in samsara. So that when we're dying, and this will come next weekend when we talk about the 12 links, but there is such grasping at existence and at me, and not wanting to stop or die or disappear. And so that grasping nurtures past karmic propensities for rebirth in samsara. So the continuity of consciousness since beginning this time has been karma and afflictions. Sometimes virtuous, but they're contaminated virtue, which occasionally leads to a happy rebirth. But there's still karma. The continuity of a Buddha's mental continuum, it has the power of bodhicitta. The bodhicitta has been getting stronger and stronger and stronger each level. I think in the text there's 20 or 22 levels, maybe 20 levels of bodhicitta getting stronger and stronger until we talk about the bodhicitta in the mind of a Buddha. So, of course, it's not the aspiration to achieve enlightenment because the person has achieved enlightenment, but the aspiration to rescue all sentient beings from suffering has become the total propulsive energy of a Buddha's mind. We were talking yesterday about free will, and I read somewhere that Christopher Hitchens, who is a great God denier, etc., was asked the question, is there free will? And his answer was, free will? Of course there's free will. We have no choice. Smart answer. But The same for a Buddha.
When His Holiness Kyabche Song Rinpoche, previous incarnation, unbelievable teacher and great teacher of Lama Zofa Rinpoche, Lama Yeshe, Tupin Yeshe, when he manifested dying, somebody asked Lama Zofa Rinpoche,
"Will he come back?"
Lama Zofa Rinpoche looked at this person with disdain and said, "Will he come back? He has no choice because of his bodhicitta. He promised. Bodhicitta is the promise to rescue all sentient beings from suffering until there's no more samsara, if there is such a thing. So the Buddhas have no choice but to be there for sentient beings in any way where they can communicate." So even Buddhas, from that point of view, don't have free will. Yeah. Obscuration to omniscience. Yeah, well, the subtle dualistic appearance, or the appearance of inherent existence, of the black vision. That's the most subtle. And then the red vision and the white vision are pretty close to that. So those are the last three subtle obscurations. Anything else? Yeah. Yeah. Start with it starts with the uninterrupted path, which becomes a liberated path. Yeah.
The second, third, fourth, they always start with
uninterrupted. Yes.
Path, and then even the white column.
That's right. So the sorry? Yeah.
You have
yeah.
So I've always wondered,
what is that? That is the post-meditational wisdom. That's when you arise from that special concentration where you entered each level of the path. So, the post-meditational wisdom is long. I mean, you can't proportionately mention it here, but there's a countless great eon, or two countless great eons. So it's a vast duration of time. The uninterrupted paths, the liberated paths, just brief moments, incredibly brief. Mostly it's the post-meditational wisdom. The mind is, and it's different because there's the post-meditational wisdom of the bodhisattva's path of seeing. And then there's the post-meditational wisdom of the Bodhisattva's first level of path of meditation. That's quite a mouthful, but the different name indicates at what level the mind of the Bodhisattva is at. And others who have reached any of these levels, they can know, they can see through the mental consciousness. Others who are at the same level and prior to that. And they cannot see the level of the person who's beyond them, but you can recognize a person who has the same level of realization that you have. Yes, that's right. It's attained on the path of seeing.
Before that,
Yeah. Yeah, I've asked that question. And so Geshe Tetchup, when he replied to my answer, he said, when you attain that first uninterrupted path of the path of seeing, that stops the affliction to be abandoned. The term is called stopping. And as I say, it's only a brief moment. It stops and then it is abandoned upon attaining the liberated path. It's called liberated because you're liberated from that level of obscuration that was stopped. So there's a difference between stopping and abandoning. Now, Rinpoche asked me that also in Taiwan in 1990. I may have even asked the same question, I think. But I was talking about the 12 links. And I said that Rinpoche, the ignorance of the 12 links, which is the first link, I said, how can that be abandoned if there's still subtle levels of ignorance, you know, to be abandoned by the path of meditation? And he sort of said, is the ignorance of the 12 links abandoned upon the path of seeing? And I got the message. I said, oh no, it's stopped. Yes. Geshe Teshok has taught you well. He said, it's stopped. The ignorance is not abandoned until you reach the eighth ground. So stopping means stopping from being active. Abandoning occurs at the end of the uninterrupted path. So uninterrupted means uninterrupted by that level of affliction. It's stopped. It cannot interrupt. And then liberated path, gone, abandoned. And that's when you achieve the true cessation. So again, these cross-hatched paths, of uninterrupted paths and liberated paths, are very brief. So I'm going deaf. Yeah. Oh, yeah. The three devils. So? The neither contemplative nor post-meditation wisdom. Yeah, okay. So, contemplative wisdom refers to the uninterrupted and the liberated paths. Post-meditational wisdom refers to the realizations, the blank bits. Now, so the question might arise, and so that's referring to meditation on emptiness, right? On emptiness. So you might ask the question, well, what about bodhicitta? If the mind is focused purely on emptiness, does the bodhisattva have bodhicitta during the contemplative, non-interrupted paths? Reasonable question. The answer is yes. There is bodhicitta, but it's not manifest in the mind of a bodhisattva on the uninterrupted path or the liberated path. You see, bodhicitta, the focus of bodhicitta is enlightenment, your Buddhahood, for the benefit of beings. So your mind can't be focused on both emptiness and Buddhahood. The mind can only have one object of single point of concentration at a time. So the query is, does bodhicitta not exist?
But yes, it does, in a non-manifest form. Yeah. The bodhisattva who has entered the first ground, you say?
Something like that, yeah.
And is on the path of seeing.
They cannot go to the tantric path anymore, but they have to go to
the
path.
I think that may be asserted by in different individual texts. But what I was taught by Geshe Jampa Techok, who taught me all this, one, a bodhisattva can enter the tantric path at any point on these five paths. But I think you're right that there are some commentators who they said, oh, you can't do it until you reach the end of the sutra path. But those are just commentaries, they're not Buddha's teachings. And they're not necessarily incorrect. It depends upon the context. But definitely, Geshe Jampa Techo said that you can enter the tantric path at any point on those five paths. Okay, I hope I haven't overwhelmed you of this subject of Salam, of grounds and paths, takes 6 months to study. When it normally is taught. But as we were talking about the true path, and this is the true path, at least, look, you've got, and I know some of you have had teaching before, so it's not totally new. For those who are completely new, you probably can't wait to get out of here. Sorry, but it's worth it. It's worth it. The imprint has been placed upon your mind stream, and I hope you are fortunate enough to be able to further receive teachings and study this subject. It's so important. So thank you all so much for your attendance and your attention during this weekend, and thank you for inviting me here to give these talks. It's always a delight to share with others what my own teachers have been so patient in teaching me. And although my presentation is nowhere near approach their eloquence and their direct personal understanding, I've tried to not make too many mistakes. But there could be mistakes, so don't say, Gyatso said... I may have been wrong. So let's dedicate all this positive energy to all sentient beings by thinking that may I quickly achieve all five paths of the Bodhisattva up to enlightenment so that I can guide all sentient beings out of suffering. Thank you so much.